Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are times when ordinary people living ordinary lives are called upon to do extraordinary things. Learning their stories can help us understand what drives people to be courageous, what gives them the tools to do courageous things. And that's the story of Moshe Gildenman. He was an engineer and musician, a pacifist, living with his family in Ukraine until, in 1942, the Nazis murdered more than 2,000 people living in his village, along with Moshe's wife and daughter. He escaped with his son, along with a revolver, a handful of bullets, and a Yiddish songbook. Prior to the Nazi invasion of his homeland in 1941, he had never picked up a weapon. Now, he was set on revenge. He joined up with Soviet partisans, who gave him his own detachment to command, ultimately becoming a guerrilla war hero and helping to liberate Ukraine from Nazi control. But his story is also one of music, and it caught the attention of James Grimes, a professor of musicology at UNC Charlotte. He retells Gildenman's story in a book called Partisan Song, a Holocaust story of resilience, resistance, and revenge. And he joins us now to share it. Good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. This is not the first book you've written about the Holocaust, not your first foray into writing about that period. The last time you were here, which was in 2012, that's a long time ago, but the last time you were here, we spoke about Violins of Hope, which is a book and exhibit and a series of concerts back then, using violins played by musicians who had been in concentration camps and the ghettos of, Warsaw. It focused on the strength of the human spirit and the power of music. This latest book is called Partisan Song. It also focuses on musicians in the time of the Holocaust. And there is a thread connecting these two stories. Talk about that.
Yes, absolutely. So in Partisan Song, I have the honor of talking about six violins and what they went through with their owners during the Holocaust. And it takes place in different times, at different places, different camps, different locations. One of those stories is that of a young boy named Mahler Schlein. He was 12 years old when the Nazis came into his hometown in Ukraine and murdered his parents and his little sister. He did happen to not be home that day, but he came home and found the bodies of his family members. And knowing that he too would be killed simply for being a Jew, he escaped to the forest and took with him his most prized possession, his violin. He wandered through the forest by himself, very interesting young man, very clever, made his way, but ultimately met up with this partisan commander, Moshe Gildenman, about whom Partisan Song tells his story. And then really young Motula established himself as a rather clever and daring young man with a real knack for espionage. So in the story I tell in Violins of Hope, it talks about Motula being able to infiltrate a Nazi soldiers club. They don't know that he's a young Jewish boy. They presume he's an ethnic Ukrainian and hire him to entertain the officers at this officers club. And so he goes there every day. He plays his violin. They sort of adopt him. He's 13 years old at this time. And they love this super talented young man. He becomes something of a mascot. And they go so far as to have a little German uniform tailored for him out of the same material they make the regular German uniforms out. So here's this 13-year-old boy. And every day he puts on his German uniform and cap and he goes and he plays for the Nazis. He entertains them. He takes their requests. He laughs at their jokes. But the entire time he's secretly eavesdropping on their conversations. And he's reporting everything back to the partisans who are, of course, in contact with the Red Army, providing valuable intelligence in the war on the Eastern Front. Now, one morning, Motula goes down to the kitchen. He gets free breakfast, free lunch, free dinner at the kitchen that's in the basement of the Soldiers Club. And he goes down the hallway and he notices there's a door that's been left slightly open. And he's a curious teenage boy. And he looks in and it's an empty storeroom with just herring barrels, wine cases, things that have just been forgotten, the normal junk in the back of a restaurant. But he also notices a crack along the wall, and he hatches a plan in his head to fill that crack with explosives and blow up this Nazi officers' club. So he goes back to his partisan commander, Uncle Misha, Moshe Gildenman, and they work out the plan. So every day he goes, he plays his full shift, he goes downstairs for his dinner right before he leaves the soldiers' club. But before he goes back into that storeroom, takes his violin out of the case, hides the violin in an empty barrel, and then walks out of the building, with that empty case as if it were any other night. And the next morning he'd returned with that same case, only now with a few pounds of explosives hidden inside the violin case. And he would go back in that storeroom, take out the explosives, hide them, put the violin back in the case, and then go about his day playing and entertaining the Germans. He did this for several days until he finally had enough explosives to blow up the building. And when the time is right, he lit that detonator and made his dramatic escape with that violin. And that violin was restored by Amnon Weinstein, this Israeli violin maker who's at the heart of Violins of Hope. And Uncle Misha's grandson later donated it to Yad Vashem, which is Israel's Holocaust Museum. And it's on permanent display. They have probably millions of artifacts, so they have to be very careful about what they put on display. But Motula's violin is on permanent display in a hall that's dedicated to those who resisted the Nazis. And it's just a few footsteps from an authentic Schindler's List.
Wow. Wow is the appropriate word. I'm more articulate than that normally, but wow is the word. That violin explains its presence in Violins of Hope. But this new book is called Partisan Song. And although it is about a person who was a musician, it's primarily not about that. Music plays a really peripheral role in this story. So why the title Partisan Song?
I really wanted to emphasize this idea of culture, because the music, it keeps coming back as a thread, but you're right. The central arc is that of Moshe Gildenman's story. But what I think inspired me the most, similar to Violins of Hope, this idea that even in the darkest of time, in Violins of Hope, people kept their instruments with them, of all things, and kept making music, and that helped them to hold on to the hope. Partisan Song is a different example of that, in that these partisans, they would be engaged in these heroic battles with the Germans during the day, but at night they would go back into their partisan camps deep in the woods where the Germans really couldn't find them. And around their campfires, they would tell stories and sing songs and dance. And so every night they were involved in this community music making. And it was a way for them to not only to remember what they had lost, but also remember everything that they were fighting for. Because they knew if they survived, their culture would survive with them.
You also write about these two different collections of, I guess, sheet music, for lack of a better term. I mentioned that Moshe Gildenman escaped from the Nazi with a gun, some bullets, his son, and a Yiddish songbook. And that songbook was later identified as a book titled Freedom's Songs. And you also discovered a trove of songs that Gildenman's son collected at the time. Were the Freedom Songs written prior to World War II in that first collection of books of music?
Yes, this was a collection with notation and the lyrics of Yiddish workers' songs. It was an organization called the Jewish Workers' Bund, sort of a union. And the Bundists believed in creating a multicultural society in Eastern Europe where the Poles, the Lithuanians, the Jews would all live peacefully side by side. As you said, he was very much a pacifist and very much believed in this multicultural society. And that's what they were trying to build. And this songbook is sort of worker songs talking about, in very militaristic terms, as it turns out, they are fighting a war to create a better society where everybody is allowed to thrive.
And so how do the songs in that book that Moshe Gildenman took with him into the forest differ from the collection of songs that his son put together and carried with him, I believe, for the rest of his life?
Yes. So Gildenman's songs, that songbook predates the war, and he held onto it as one of the only things he carried with him because he just walked out of the ghetto, barely escaping in time before the final liquidation. Later on, his son started collecting song text. There's no notation, but it's different texts. And they're all on different types of paper, and they're all in different hands. And some of them bear inscriptions. So it's sort of like, today we might have a yearbook at the end of school, right? And everybody signs something, a little message. So many of them have that types of inscriptions in memory of hanging out with you on this date. Don't forget we met here. And these are the songs that they would sing in the Red Army and other places, again, singing around the campfire, perhaps, to inspire each other. And he collected those as sort of mementos of people he'd met and songs they had sung together. And yes, he kept that for the rest of his life, and eventually those ended up in Yad Vashem in Israel as well.
Moshe Gilderman, we're going to hear his story of his exploits during the war. But prior to the war, prior to the Nazi invasion of his little town in Ukraine, he was a civic leader. He was a civil engineer. He was a musician, and he was a composer. He was kind of a cultural leader of Koretz, if that's how you say it, Koretz, Ukraine.
Yes.
Do any of the songs that he composed remain?
Very few. There is a song from a musical he wrote, The King of the Schnorrers, very sort of Jewish Yiddish theme. And after the war, there's a tradition where the few survivors of some of these little towns, they would come together and publish books. They call it Yizkor books or memory books. And you have them from all these tiny towns. And for many cases, including Koretz, it's really the only place we have for information about these towns that barely survive, or if they survive, they're very different towns now because they're once primarily Jewish towns, and then during the Holocaust, their Jewish population was decimated. And there are memoirs of survivors, and one of them specifically remembers and retells one of the stories, one of the songs that Gildenman had written for this musical that he wrote for the town to perform. There's another song that Gildenman wrote just as he was leaving the ghetto. He's writing to encourage his fellow Jews to join him. And unfortunately, wasn't successful in most cases. The Nazi power was just so overwhelming, most people gave up hope. But he writes this song about the heartbreak and pain of being robbed of all their possessions and crammed into this tiny ghetto and constantly under the brutality and duress of the Nazis. And in the end of the third verse, he asks, "Is it not better to die as men in a heroic battle?" And then the fourth verse is sort of the call to arms. He writes, "Young and old, come to the forest," meaning escape the ghetto and come with me to take up arms. And he admits, 10 may fall, but 10 will survive. Forward, all Jews, to the fight," is how that song ends.
And that was his philosophy that led him to the kind of exploits that he undertook as Uncle Misha, which was his
Yes.
nickname, as I guess the Nazis would have called him a terrorist. He was a freedom fighter. And
Yes.
it was that attitude that propelled him, and we'll talk about that as we go through it. Since all eyes, not all eyes, but many eyes are on Ukraine today for
Sure.
other reasons, talk about where Koretz, his little village, was. And does
Yes,
it still exist?
it does still exist. I don't believe any Jews still live there. Gildenman tried to return there at the end of the war, and he sort of walked these streets where everything he grew up with had been reduced to rubble, and there was nobody left. And the ethnic Ukrainians that he'd grown up with and played in the streets with and been friends with and done business with, they had all turned their backs. And in fact, in many cases, the Ukrainian nationalists participated in the torture and murder of the Jews.
So I have about 10 seconds left. Where in Ukraine was Koretz, or is Koretz?
Northwestern Ukraine. So out of the fighting right now, at least,
Okay.
I'd say.
When we come back, we'll hear more of Moshe's story, what he did during the war, the exploits, the way he helped these folks fight off the Nazis. It's Charlotte Talk.
In salzigen Jam von die menschliche gefind sich a schrecklicher Tom, gefind sich a schrecklicher Tom. Kenn scheu nit tiefer, nit finsterer wern. Im Zeichen da blutiger Strom, der Kennscheune tiefer, nicht finsterer werden.
It's a song called In the Salty Sea. That's the translation of it. It's a worker song from that 1919 Yiddish songbook that Moshe Gildenman carried with him throughout the war. Would you like to add to that, Jay Grimes?
Yeah, it's an interesting song. That first verse we just heard, in the salty sea of human tears, there's a terrible abyss. It couldn't be darker, it couldn't be deeper, and it's marked with a bloody tide. It's talking about the persecution of Jews, specifically Jewish workers. And one of the reasons why I suggested we play this song is we know that Gildenman knew this song. Not only was it in that songbook, but this is one of many songs that have his markings. There's several markings in his copy of the Yiddish songbook they took with them that indicate that he may have led performances from it, perhaps. Sometimes there's solfège syllables that say, we're going to sing this in the key of whatever, or other markings. And in this case, there are two lines in this particular poem that were so controversial at the time that the original editor, where there's two lines, he just put ellipses there to censor those. And Gildenman went in and wrote him back in by hand because he apparently felt so strong about preserving the text of this song.
So let's talk about his story. In 1942, as I said, the Nazis murdered 2,220 members of the Jewish community in that village, including his wife and his daughter. But the Nazis had been in Ukraine since 1941, and a lot of members of Gildenman's community in Ukraine believed that they would be left alone by the Nazis until it was too late. And some others believed that if they cooperated, if they worked in the jobs that they were assigned by the Nazis, that they would be protected. That's a story that's been repeated over and over again throughout World War II, throughout the Nazi-controlled territories. Yeah. Looking back, was that naivete? Was it a defense mechanism to quell fear? Both?
Yes, I think both. The Germans knew exactly what they were doing, and they would leave just enough thread to give a little bit of hope. Say, okay, well, we've killed a lot of people, but we left you behind because you're useful, and we need you for the war effort. So your ability to be useful to our cause, it's what is going to save your life. And of course, their plan was the second they were no longer useful would be to kill them. But, you know, this idea of hope, to answer your question, in retrospect, naivete, yes, but sometimes in the worst of conditions, that little thread of hope, even if only in retrospect it proves to be naive, is the only thing we have and the only thing we can hang on to. And so that's in these most desperate of times, if there was a sliver of chance that they were going to survive, they would hold on to that, and in most cases, unfortunately, until it was too late.
And that idea of holding on to hope followed what happened when the Nazis arrived in Koretz in 1941. You write that they gathered all the rabbis. The first thing they did, gathered all the rabbis serving a community of 4,000 Jews, marched them to the synagogues, forced them to take out the sacred Torah scrolls into the streets, doused them with gasoline, and burned them. This is like, for Christians, burning Bibles, only worse.
For sure.
Those who refused to do that were shot. Was that not a wake-up call for the Jewish population in Koretz?
It was, to an extent, but I think sometimes we underestimate the overwhelming force. I mean, in our society, a free society, you know, we can't even imagine what it would be like to live under their circumstances. And this is a community that's been maligned for centuries. And in some senses, they've just grown accustomed to that's the status quo. That is what it's like, unfortunately, to be a Jew in Eastern Europe. And one of the survivors even said, he wasn't a survivor, but a survivor remember him saying, yeah, okay, so there have been a couple Jews here and there who have been shot. But when in history have Jews not been shot and killed?
Well, the Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, which is controlled by Moscow, Russia, and Russia had its own series of pogroms over the years to do something similar to the Jewish population. You say that Germans roamed the town, beating and or killing every Jew they saw, and finally arrived at Moshe's door. But the atrocities didn't all occur on the same day. They unfolded repeatedly over a period of time. How quickly did life for Jews in Koretz change?
Well, immediately after the Nazi invasion.
Okay.
They immediately stripped the Jews of their civil rights. They forced them to wear the yellow badge, which immediately ostracized them. And Gilderman wrote later in one of his books about the first time he walked around with the yellow badge. In some places it was a star. You have to wear one on your chest and one on your back. And the same people he'd grown up with and he considered his friends and fellow community members, they would ridicule him all of a sudden. And he really felt that the badge, the yellow badge on the back of his black jacket was a bullseye, that at any moment someone's just going to take out a gun and shoot him, which would have been perfectly legal.
The fact that the governing authorities were making them identify themselves and belittling them gave license to others who had been benign toward the Jews to do the same thing. And there
Absolutely.
Is a lesson in that for us today. Some of the moves the Nazis made seem very familiar to modern eyes because we've seen them in movies, we've read them in books, the mistreatment of Jews and others considered subhuman, epithets thrown at them by the Germans, rights stripped away, businesses closed, restrictions placed on travel and exactly where within a particular city the Jews could go, othering and ostracizing them, even conscripting them into forced labor and murdering them at the slightest provocation, if any provocation at all. To us, that's old news, but to them, that must have been both frightening and bewildering because that's not normal. Difficult for them to wrap their heads around. There are some who see parallels to what's happening in this country today. Are those folks being paranoid or merely applying lessons from the past?
I would think there are certainly some lessons to be learned. There are some echoes. Is it the exact same thing? I don't think so. But this idea, as you said, of othering, of scapegoating, that's really what it boils down to, are folks who do not believe that they have achieved what they are owed in life and do not believe it could possibly be their own fault and are looking for someone else to blame. And it typically is the others. And in Eastern Europe, for centuries, it was the Jews, especially after the Jews started to integrate more into European society.
Things turned very bad for Moshe Gildenman and his family in May of 1942 during a time of what was called special registration. Mm-hmm. When these folks were told they had to gather for registration, whatever that meant, the men and the women were separated. This is an old trope. Moshe's wife and daughter went into one line. He and his son went into the other line. And it was through the efforts of Simcha, his son, that he and a nephew were sent to a work detail as opposed to meeting some other fate. But later, the nephew would be assigned to go through a cart of clothing collected from people in that line. And he discovered coats that were being worn by Moshe's wife and daughter. Did they understand at that moment what had happened?
I think at that moment is when they finally understood. So there had been smaller events where they would sort of round up a few hundred of the wealthier Jews and send them off. They'd say it was for work detail. We're just sending them to work somewhere else. They'll be fine. We'll put them to work, but they'll be back someday. But of course, they never came back because they were marched somewhere and shot and buried in mass graves. But again, that's fait accompli for us. Only in hindsight do we really understand what that was. They knew people were disappearing. They weren't feeling good about it. But again, the only way forward was to sort of hope for the best, hope that their concerns were unwarranted. But in this day, this was rounding up the entire Jewish population and marching 2,200 of them away. And when the carts came back, so they lined them up. They dug two pits, one for the women and children, one for the men. They made them strip naked, and they took all of their clothes to send back to Germany. One of the things the Germans were trying to do to not only occupy Eastern Europe, but plunder it of natural resources as well as any valuables, including clothing. And so when they saw the clothes that when Moshe saw the clothes that his wife had been wearing that morning and his 13-year-old daughter had been wearing, that's when he ultimately knew the truth. But he and Simcha and the nephew had been spared, again, because they were proved to be useful. He was an engineer. They were working as construction workers as the Nazis were building army barracks and things like that. And so since they were able to prove their usefulness, they were able to stay alive. But yes, that was the day that they really realized. And that was the day that Moshe decided, we have to fight back. We have to do something. And again, unfortunately, most of his neighbors did not agree. They thought, well, no, those people are gone. It was, you know, almost everybody lost at least one family member, if not everybody else in their family. Yeah. But they're still alive, and the Germans apparently still think that they're useful, and so they can keep going.
It should be pointed out that Moshe was relatively young at the time. He was in his 40s, I believe, and his son yes. was an electrician, so he had value. He was assigned to do all kinds of electrical work for the Nazis. You yes. write about the thoughts. You write about the thoughts that you say were flooding through Moshe's mind following the murder of his wife and daughter. You write about his speaking to a group of fellow Jews gathered to mourn their dead and chastising them for mm-hmm. not being more concerned with, a desecrated Torah than about their fellow Jews and meeting their end. And you quote him ending that outburst with, "I will not go like a sheep to the slaughter." Are you speculating about that, or was that somehow documented?
Yes, good question. So that is documented in Gilderman's own writings. So after the Holocaust, he sees that there are these monuments being erected to the conquering heroes, right? And it's always the military heroes, but not the Jews, none of the Jewish fighters. So he sets himself as a mission to document some of this. So one of the books he writes is about his life in the Kretz ghetto because he wants to bear witness to what had happened. And so he is reporting what was going through his mind at the time. Another book, he writes this biography of the young Motula, the young violinist who infiltrates a Nazi club, because he says he wants to pay homage to the children, and there were many children who joined in the fight. The largest of his four books, the longest, was actually dedicated to women combatants, because he wanted the next generation to know that there were not only Jewish heroes, but Jewish heroines who fought valiantly to liberate Ukraine, but also to avenge the murders of their loved ones.
While he was waiting for his moment to escape from the ghetto that the Nazis had constricted them to, you mentioned this song. He wrote this song called Come to the Forest, which was a call to arms, essentially, to his fellow Jews. How was that song transmitted without being discovered by their captors?
It was certainly transmitted within the ghetto and probably beyond. You know, they're tightly controlled, but there's always a little bit, you know, someone will escape just for a little bit to go hear what's going on in another ghetto and then come back. They're still keeping communication lines open. In fact, when they're in the ghetto, Simcha, Moshe's son, actually starts sneaking out and he makes contact with some Soviet partisans. And that's what first inspires him. He does it secretly for a while and then tells his father about it.
This, you're a musicologist, but this book, which is not fiction, it's a historical truth. It's a page turner. But I guess your major interest in this is as a musician, as a musicologist. Talk to me about the power of music mm-hmm. to inspire, to bring people together, to motivate in times like Moshe's time.
Sure. So there's this expression that we hear a lot, that music is the universal language, right? And it's really problematic because every culture has its own type of music, just as every culture has its own language. So saying music is an international language is like saying language is an international language. the kernel of truth, though, in that is that making music is an innately human activity. As long as there's been histories of human, there's been histories of humans making music. And for many of us, myself included, some of our earliest memories of perhaps our mother singing to us or, you know, singing songs with our friends. And so music is an intrinsically human activity. It's a intrinsically communal activity. It's something we enjoy doing with others. That's why we have orchestras and bands and choirs. But it's also a form of cultural expression. just like language or food or architecture, how we choose our music, what we listen to, and what we perform says a lot about how we identify as human beings and with whom we identify. So continuing to make one's own music, and this happened, you know, we mentioned the Warsaw Ghetto. People might remember the pianist Władysław Spielman in the Warsaw Ghetto for that movie with Adrian Brody. They continued to make music, even in Auschwitz, even in the very worst of places, when they had the few spare seconds they had to be together, they would choose to do that by making music. And making music was a way to exercise spiritual resistance, even when physical resistance wasn't possible, telling themselves, the Nazis have stripped much of our humanity, but they will not strip who we are, and we're going to express that by holding on to our culture and our music.
Soon after being herded into that ghetto by the auxiliary police, the Ukrainian auxiliary police and the Nazis, his son, Simcha, wanted to escape, but he, Moshe, being the engineer, I guess, the planner that he was, wanted to wait. He wanted to wait and organize. But ultimately, they did make their escape, and just in the nick of time, because they were about to obliterate everybody in that ghetto. How did they accomplish that?
They had, again, sort of spies. There was a doctor who would attend. The Germans had a little hospital for wounded Soviet prisoners of war, but they would send them out for work details. And then one day, all of the Soviet soldiers were gone. And the doctor said, where is everybody? Oh, well, they're preparing for this. Something big is about to happen, and they're preparing for it. So the doctor came back to the Jewish community and told them, and for most of them, it was just too late. But Gilliman had been preparing, and so he said, now is the time. If we wait any longer, it's going to be too late. So there were only 12, him, his son, his nephew, and 9 other Jews who had ultimately decided that they were going to make an escape. And they left in 4 groups of 3, and Gilliman left with his son and with his nephew. He had that revolver with 5 bullets that he'd managed to buy from a pole. But he decided if they were caught, he was going to shoot his nephew, he'd shoot his son, and then shoot himself, because that would be better than what would come to them had they been caught by the Nazis.
And that's the beginning of a remarkable story which follows his exploits as a partisan fighter. We'll come back with more in a moment. Our guest is James Grimes from UNC Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks.
Dort beim Breck von Veldl steht ein alter Bäum, schöpfen seine Blätter, als mein Herz sei kaum, schöpfen und erzählen, wie es starb da Held, wenn es fallen Keulen über Wald und Feld, schöpfen und erzählen, wie es starb da Held, wenn es fallen Keulen über Wald und Feld.
There at the edge of the forest, which is where we left off our story, because that is where they escaped when they left the ghetto. There we go.
The ghetto.
It's a Yiddish translation of a Soviet partisan song. What's it about?
It's about a mother who finds her son's body. He's been killed in partisan combat. So there at the edge of the forest, we see a mother standing over the body of her son, weeping and mourning his loss.
Our guest today is James Grimes. He's a professor of musicology at UNC Charlotte and author of a new book that just was released called Partisan Song, a Holocaust story of resilience, resistance, and revenge. It is the story of Moshe Gilliman, who was a normal person, a civil engineer prior to the war. But once the war started and the Nazis killed his wife and daughter, he became a freedom fighter, a partisan in the Red Army, the Soviet Red Army, ultimately. And he left the ghetto, as we said, with a Yiddish songbook, a revolver with 5 bullets, and 12 other people. Before the war, he was a pacifist. He had never fired a weapon. Where did he get the gun, and how did he know how to use it?
He barely knew how to use it. He got it from a local Polish villager, and the local Poles were happy to exchange whatever they would for the very last belongings that the Jews had that hadn't been stolen from them by the Germans. But that's all he could find, was that one revolver with 5 bullets. He'd never even held a weapon, and he'd never had a chance to even try, but that's all he had.
There were those at the beginning of this conflict in the Jewish community who thought it would be more important to do whatever they could to save their fellow Jews, yes, more important than to kill Germans. Moshe Gilderman took that tact. He set out to kill as many Germans as he could, even if it meant leaving Jewish refugees behind. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a Sophie's choice, to be honest here. And when you look at the results of his efforts, how do you gauge his decision to take that approach?
Yes, it's a interesting decision. The other side of that coin would be the famous Bielski brothers from the movie Defiance with Daniel Craig and others. And they decided they wanted to save as many Jewish lives as possible, even at the expense of going into combat. But Gilderman, he was convinced that he was going to die. And so he just prepared himself to die, but wanted to take as many Germans with him as possible. He said, I know I'm going to die, but before I die, let me kill at least one German. Let me make one German wife a widow and one German boy an orphan. Only then can I rest in peace. So he thought that he was going to die, that everybody's going to die anyway, but he was bound to go down swinging.
He was able ultimately to be effective because somehow he was able to join up with the Red Army. Stalin had decided to create partisan units to disrupt the German war effort. And when he connected with fellow partisans fighting with the Russians, he was asked how many fighters he had with him and how many weapons they had. And he replied, quote, my group consists of 10 men and 2 women. We have one revolver with 5 bullets and one butcher's knife that's about a half yard long. What was their response to that?
They basically laughed at him and said he would not be of any use to them and sent them on their way. And he realized if he can't join the Soviets, which has been his goal, he was going to have to become a partisan on his own and figure out a way to arm his little group. And so, as you said, he's an engineer, he's a planner. And so he learned that there was a woodsman nearby who had a shotgun and a rifle. And he wanted to take those, but he couldn't with just one revolver. So he had to convince them that they were much bigger and much more armed than they were. So they stitched together bark that looked like pistols and painted them black. And he marched up to the guy's door where he knew he could be overheard through the front windows and said, you know, you 10, you go over here and guard the back. And they all marched off to the back as loudly as they could and then snuck back silently to the front. Now you 10, you go over here. Now you 10, you go over here. And they go off as loudly as they could and then sneak back to convince this forester that he was surrounded by 100 heavily armed partisans. And only then did the woodsman give up those weapons without a single fight because he thought he was outmanned and outgunned. And then they used those weapons to launch more attacks and kept arming themselves as they went.
That's just one of his very many tricky tactics, which we'll explore in a moment. But where did that creativity come from in him? I mean, it's a very creative, sneaky thing to do.
Right. I think, you know, he was a cultured man. He was well-educated. He was creative by nature as a musician and someone who directed and wrote plays and musicals. So I think this combination of his engineering background, his engineer's brain, but also what he was first and foremost was a community organizer. And that's what he had done his whole adult life in his hometown. And so he brings together those skills as a planner and as a bringing together of people to really craft these intricate, complex missions.
He became, during the American Revolution, Francis Marion became known as the Swamp Fox because of his exploits and his ability to evade the British and sneak back into the swamps. He, too, adopted his own name, his own nom de plume, Uncle
nom de guerre.
Misha. Okay, yeah. Yes, nom de guerre. Uncle Misha. Where did that come from?
So Misha is actually a diminutive of Moshe, which was his real name. It's also, you know, Mikhail Baryshnikov in the Russian. And right. So this first attack with this forester, the forester says, well, we can't just leave me here without these weapons because the Germans know I have them. And if they come here asking for them, they're going to think I gave them to the partisans voluntarily. And so Moshe thinks for a minute and he goes, all right, I'll, how about if I make you a receipt? And he writes down the serial numbers and everything. I've stolen this from your servant. So I, a Jewish person, can avenge the deaths of those who have been, the innocents who've been killed. And then he decides to sign it. So he's like, the leader of this partisan detachment, and he pauses for a second, and his nephew says, you know, Uncle Misha, which is what he always called him, like Uncle Billy or Uncle Bobby. Uncle Misha, you know, what are we going to do next? And that's when he decides, I'm going to call myself Uncle Misha. And he signs that receipt, Uncle Misha, and that's the name under which he fights for the rest of the war.
It was not a one-time thing. Uncle Misha became known to the Germans because of some of the things that he did. Among the tactics, he would, you say, go to a local government building, and he would make a phone call to the district office, identifying himself as Uncle Misha, Uncle Misha calling, and stating that the village had been overrun by his partisan detachment and was in desperate need of assistance, so that they would dispatch help. He'd hang up, destroy the phone so it couldn't be used again, burn all the documents in the building, and then escape to the next village. What did that accomplish?
A lot of this is propaganda. It's psychological warfare. So he needed to convince the Germans that he created this mystique that nobody can touch Uncle Misha. And he's come, you never know where he's coming from, you never know where he's going to, and kept them always afraid of what was coming next. But also the local villagers who had sort of given up as well. They weren't Jews, they weren't being prosecuted like the Jews were, but the Nazis were coming, they were stealing all of their livestock, they were robbing them all their possessions, they were kidnapping their children and sending them back to Germany for forced labor. But the villages had sort of given up because of the overwhelming force of the Germans. But the fact that there's these pockets of partisans, specifically Uncle Misha's group, successfully embarrassing the Germans on an almost daily basis, started changing their mindsets. And that's another song I found that Gildenmann had wrote in Russian. This is now when he's an independent partisan, telling the local villagers, look, these Germans, they've come, they've robbed your belongings, they've kidnapped your children. Come with me, take up arms, join me in this fight to liberate our homeland. And he titles the song, the Soviets had been dropping propaganda flyers for a while, and one of the more popular terms was Death to the German Robbers. And so that's the title that Gildenmann gives this song. And then he prints it up and distributes it as far as wise as he can as a song for people to sing to urge them to join him in combat.
How many exploits did he conduct? And at the height of his success, how many people were with him in his group?
It really varies because there are some that are captured and killed, and then he'll find other Jews who had escaped from their ghettos and were wandering in the forest, and so he'd join up with them, and then they'd sort of disappear. So this almost revolving cast. So anywhere between 12 and maybe 35 members. And then when he joins up with the Soviet partisans, they break that group up, but then give him his own new Jewish group.
And it wasn't just these dirty tricks that he played on the Germans, like calling in fake attacks and making them come to nothing. He was willing to go to extreme lengths. You write about his arriving at a house. They were trying to, I think, had to do with a water supply or something. Mm-hmm. They knew there was a woman inside this house. She, in a phony kind of way, invited them in and was very polite and told them to have dinner with her, etc. But he was on to her. And as they were coming in the door, he heard a phone ringing. And for some reason, that told him that she was participating with the Germans. So he had her call them to say that she was wrong. He assumed that she had made a report that they were there and that she needed help. She had him call him to say that she was wrong, that they had already left, and he warned her that he would shoot her if he betrayed him. She did. And that's exactly what he did. He shot her in the head. How often would he take it that far?
That was one of the more brutal scenes, but not by any stretch of imagination the most brutal. There are some moments in there that I really, you know, sort of blushed and hesitated to write. But, you know, if we're going to tell the historical truth, we have to tell the entire historical truth. There are some very dark, brutal moments. And again, it's this arc of this man who, as we've already discussed, was very peaceful, never held a weapon. And then when pushed to the extreme, was capable of extraordinary violence in exacting revenge for not only his own wife and daughter, but so many, many, many others. But then after the war, you know, he joins the Red Army and goes all the way to Berlin. And then he, once the Nazis are defeated, he puts down his weapons and goes back to a life of peace. In fact, he's part of an organization. This is 46, 47 in Poland, that's working to create a single state in Palestine or Israel, where the Israelis and the Palestinians can live in a single state side by side.
There were partisans all over occupied Europe who were fighting against the Nazis and doing things to hinder their activities. How would you calculate the success or the impact of his efforts?
He was among the most successful partisans in the Eastern Front, and historians will tell you that those partisans were crucial to Russia's victory. You know, the war was brutal on the Eastern Front, but one of the keys to success was these partisans behind enemy lines. They're disrupting supply chains, they're blowing up trains and blowing up bridges, and they're making sure supplies and personnel can't get to the Eastern Front.
At the end of the war, you write that he was one of the first conquering heroes to walk the streets of Berlin. You write, quote, he went to the Reich Chancellery. In Goebbels' office, on the wall above the desk from which Goebbels had briefly led Germany, he wrote in large letters in Russian, German, and Yiddish, Hitler and Goebbels, I, Moshe, son of Asher HaLevi of Koretz, I hope I said the name even remotely Definitely. Correctly, have outlived you and your ridiculous racial theory. And he signed his legal name, Moshe Gildenman, as well as his partisan name, Uncle Misha. That's a movie ending. After the war, he wrote several books of his own, and he lectured seriously. Why don't more people know this story?
It's probably a mystery to us, but it probably boils down to good old anti-Semitism, in that the reason he decided to start documenting this was he was seeing that the Jewish voices were being erased, and that was his attempt, and that he was briefly successful. He was a minor celebrity. But by the 50s, by the mid-50s, he was all but forgotten.
And there were little bits and pieces of his story out there, and you said that it was your goal to assemble the first complete chronicle of his activities. Clearly that you have achieved that. What do you hope people take from this book?
I think it's a lesson in both holding on to one's values, even when things seem desperate, even when one is grossly outnumbered and outmanned. Nevertheless, staying faithful to your own values and fighting for what you believe in and fighting for what is right.
Late in the book, near the end of the war, you say Simcha, Moshe's son, had started compiling a songbook, and we've talked about this a little bit, that he would keep with him for the rest of his life. Soviet war songs, Polish songs, two Yiddish songs, one of which was a copy of his father's song, Come to the Forest. As a musicologist, which is more interesting or musically or historically important, that compilation or the Yiddish songbook that Moshe carried with him?
Honestly, probably that compilation, because we know then exactly what they collected themselves in the moment, what they were singing.
We're going to close with Partisan Song, since that's the name of the book. Partisan Song, a Holocaust story of resilience, resistance, and revenge, by our guest this hour, James Grimes, a professor of musicology at UNC Charlotte. This is set to a Russian war song. It commemorates the Jewish heroes of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Partisan Song. Thank you for the event.
Das nicht gesungen mit Nagane in die Hand. Das hat der Volk zwischen Fallen nicht gewendet. Das nicht gesungen mit Nagane in die Hand. Das hat nicht keimel, als du gehst dem letzten Weg. Hat schimmeln bleiene verstellen bläue Teg. Kommen wird noch unser ausgebänkte Schoen. Es wird erbeugt und unser Trott mir seinen Don. Kommen wird noch unser ausgebänkte Schoen. Es wird erbeugt und unser Trott mir seinen Don.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.